Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll also uncover the historical context and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in.
So, I have something really exciting, but I just need to preface this by saying, if you are my dad, turn this off right now, because it is my dad's birthday in a week, and I don't want him to know this until then.
Oh, so just, if this is Emma's dad, skip ahead like a minute or two.
Or okay? Listen to this after your birthday, please.
Okay. Here's the little pause. Here's the little pause for Emma's dad to skip. Okay.
We're back. Everyone but my dad now. So, my dad and I, we really share a love for music. We both do. And when I was a kid, my dad really much raised me on Bob Dylan, Johnny Cash, that kind of music. Mm-hmm. It's what he really loves. He also loves the Velvet Underground, Pink Floyd. That's kind of like cool. His music. A couple of other things too.
Dad rock.
Substantially dad rock. And when I was a kid, I remember I didn't get Bob Dylan. Like, as a toddler or kindergartner, I was like, what kind of music? It's not melodic. I don't. And yeah, I was like a musical theater kid.
What is he talking about with all of these, like, hard rains and...
Oh, I didn't understand a thing. I had no idea.
I don't know.
I was just like, what is this music? But then, like, as the years progressed, I'd say, as I turned, like, 10, 12, I really started to fall in love with the music. Mm. So now my dad and I are so on the same page about music. And so his birthday came around, and I was like, man, what am I going to do for his birthday? Because my thing is, I always love to give people experiences. I think it's just, I mean, especially when you're grown up, like, I don't need to give my father any kind of, like, thing. I don't know.
Because you're giving people memories as opposed to tangible things, and those memories last a lot longer.
That's what kind of where my thought process was. And so one day, I was walking down the street and I look to this ad and I see Bob Dylan coming. And I was like, wait, but like coming to Germany. So I was like, okay, maybe he's going to come somewhere close to where we live. Mm-hmm. And then I saw that he's playing a show in early October or like mid-October in my hometown where my dad still lives.
Oh my gosh.
Able to get his tickets.
That's so awesome. I saw Dylan for the first time with my mom.
Oh, that's sweet. I've never seen him live. I'm so excited.
Here's the thing with Dylan is he reworks his songs to such an effect that you don't know it's the song until maybe halfway or three quarters of the way through. Like, I didn't know that my first Dylan song was Simple Twist of Fate. And he played it at my show. This would have been about 5 years ago. And I didn't know that it was Simple Twist of Fate until maybe three quarters of the way through. I was just enjoying it as this really nice song with this great band.
Oh, that's great.
He also played Make You Feel My Love. And my mom cried because that's like my mom and I's song. We love that song.
Oh, that's so sweet.
So interesting that you bring up Dylan because I just rewatched the Rolling Thunder film. The Scorsese film. I just rewatching last night. It's so good. Yeah. So we're just like on a Dylan wave right now. I dig it.
Yes. And I'm so truly excited. I know my dad's seen him live a couple of times, but I have never. So this is going to be really exciting.
It's gonna be
I'm
really
forever
going
to be jealous because my dad, he's seen so many great bands. He's also seen Johnny Cash.
Wow. That's an all-timer.
Yeah, I think so. And I think he said the concert wasn't, I think he's seen him two times as well, and he said one concert was really great, and then the second one, he was definitely very drunk, and it, like, very much affected the concert as to him forgetting the lyrics, and it just wasn't as amazing, but it's, like, my dad's all-time favorite musician, so he obviously went. And then also, my parents went to the Rolling Stones before I was born. My mom went pregnant to a Rolling Stones concert.
That's awesome. So your first concert was the Rolling Stones.
Yeah, I mean, technically,
I love that.
So yeah, I think that's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really excited to surprise him with that because I don't think he sees that coming.
I can't wait to hear how your gig is and what Dylan even plays because, you know, he's got such a huge back catalog. And, you know, he's been playing like a Rolling Stone for 60 years. He won't want to play that. He'll pull something that you've never heard and you'll be like, wow, this is my new favorite thing.
And from my understanding, it's like a concert, but he also reads some of like his written things.
Ooh, we didn't.
Some poetry.
That's
some
new.
I think so. So we'll see.
I'm really excited.
This was so funny because like my dad always says, by the way that you get tickets and like when you see the seating chart, you already know what's like the age group that is most likely going to attend. And so when I went, I was like, is there like just, because usually I just get the regular ticket, right? And I don't get like a seated place because why would I? And then I looked, Bob Dylan, you can only get like a chair. There's no dancing.
yeah. Then no floor seats, no lawn.
It's going to be fine though. I'm so excited.
Yeah, it's going to be great.
So today we are going to talk about someone kind of close to probably the most influential band of the 1960s, this isn't about them, this is about her.
Yes.
Today's doll is the woman that inspired several Beatles songs like And I Love Her, You Won't See Me, I'm Looking Through You, What You're Doing, Things We Said, and For No One. She was one of the original Beatles girls, Paul McCartney's first true love, and the one that got away. Today we are talking about the wonderful Jane Asher. Usually when we talk about someone on this podcast, we read their biographies or hundreds of articles about them. This episode is a little different. I really tried my very best to find as much as possible about Jane, but besides her time with Paul McCartney and her work, not really that much is known about her. So a lot of today's episode comes from Wikipedia, different articles, and a couple of interviews she did. So let's dive into the wonderful life of Jane Asher.
Jane Asher was born on April 5th, 1946, in Willesden, Greater London, as the middle child of three to parents Richard and Margaret Asher. Her father was a consultant specializing in blood and mental diseases at the Central Middlesex Hospital, as well as a broadcaster and respected author of medical articles. Jane's mother, born Margaret Elliott, was a professor at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama. The Ashers were a very educated and rather posh family that prioritized a good education for their children. Jane attended Northbridge House School, Miss Lambert's School for Girls in Paddington, and later Queen's College in Harley Street, London. Jane grew up in a creative environment, especially with her older brother, Peter. He became one half of the duo Peter and Gordon. They were quite popular among teens in the mid-60s. I think I have one of their singles.
Oh, wow. Until I read about this in the episode, I didn't know how much I actually listened to this song. I never made the connection that Peter and Gordon were part of like the Asher family. I had no idea.
Both Asher siblings were exposed to the arts early thanks to their mother's career teaching music and drama. Quote, Jane's always been interested in music. She plays flute and guitar, so we can both help and criticize each other in a friendly way, Peter later said. Jane began acting at a young age, and soon she gained traction as a child actress. At just 6 years old, she appeared in the 1952 film Mandy. In 1955, she starred in the science fiction film The Quartermass Experiment. A talent agent fell in love with her voice, so she started booking voice acting roles. In 1959, she was cast as Alice for Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass for Argo Records.
Oh dear, they're all knocked. How am I ever to get out again? Oh, what a funny little table. It's made of solid glass. And there's a tiny golden key lying on it. But the key's much too small to unlock any of the doors. And this, perhaps, behind this little curtain. Oh yes, there's a tiny little door about 15 inches high. Yes, it fits.
This would be an audiobook of sorts, pressed to vinyl, which is totally, it's obsolete nowadays, and it's really cool.
But we have a couple of them, because I sometimes get them. Yeah, I sometimes get them at, like, the thrift store for my son, because he has a little record player, and so we will play them. It's mostly, like, old tales, But it's actually really nice. I like it. I remember as a kid, I used to have cassettes and I would just listen to. And it's kind of like the same thing. My dad actually said that as a child, he would listen a lot to records with like stories, Winnetou, all that kind of stuff.
Dad would have liked us both to be doctors, Jane said, but he didn't mind when we didn't take it up. Mother is a composer and teaches as well. Her brother added, Mum feels the pop life is a bit funny, but she gets annoyed when some of her pupils go snobby and think they're very hip by saying pop is terrible. It's safe to say the Ashers were very proud of their children and supported both their careers. Jane's work ethic was astonishing, even at a young age. In 1961, Jane co-starred in The Green Gage Summer, which was released in the United States as Loss of Innocence. She also appeared in the 1962 film and Disney TV special The Prince and the Pauper. She was also seen on a handful of TV shows in the late 50s and all through the 1960s. About acting, she later said, quote, "Of all the things I do, acting is the thing that grabs most, but there's another level on which it strikes me as being a little silly. In the end, you're dressing up and deciding to be somebody."
So let's talk about the moment that forever changed her life and brought her into an even bigger spotlight. On April 18th, 1963, she attended the Royal Albert Hall for the Radio Luxembourg Listeners' Poll concert, a multi-artist show featuring several popular acts of the time. That night, the Springfields, Shane Fenton, and various other artists played. Jane was 17 and already an accomplished actress. She was well known to many Brits for being on the popular TV show Jukebox Jury, which aired on BBC from 1959 to 1967. It was a music-based panel game show where a panel of celebrities and musicians would listen to and discuss new singles that were about to be released. The panelists would then predict whether each song would be a hit or a flop.
That sounds like... gosh, there was this series in Melody Maker magazine, this YouTube channel that I love, Yesterday's Papers, does this series where they go through all these back issues of Melody Maker and all these like famous artists will be commenting on each other's work. There's one that I really love where Noel Redding of the Jimi Hendrix Experience is talking about like the Fifth Dimension and songs that Cream do. It's really cool. So I see why this show would have been a hit.
Oh yeah, I mean it ran for 8 years.
That's a long time in TV time.
That night she was there for work. Jane was supposed to interview a new band on the bill, a group of four boys from Liverpool calling themselves The Beatles. She had read and noted their names, Paul, John, George, and Ringo, but found it hard to keep track of who was who. Their identical hairstyles and outfits really didn't help. When The Beatles took the stage, the volume of the screams reached new levels. Jane had witnessed ecstatic crowds before, such as during Elvis Presley's UK visits, but this was different, something more intense. As the band began to play, the music filled the room, and she was struck by its surprising complexity. The melodies had unexpected twists, far from the simple pop she was used to. When she finally got a good look at them, she thought, "These guys are worth screaming for." She turned to the photographer beside her. His smile of approval encouraged her, and Jane covered her ears and let out a scream as loud as she could.
Oh, I love that.
Me too.
Just why Beatles gigs in the 60s were so special is because all these crowds were just a sea of girls being girls.
Yes. I think you always forget how young they all were.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I think the fact that the Beatles were like 20... not even 20 yet, some of them. Age-wise, they were really close to their audience. Yeah. And I think it really helped set off the entire Beatlemania.
Mm-hmm. After the concert, Jane made her way through the crowd to get backstage. She was looking for the band, but the Beatles found her first. The four clean-cut boys in suits surrounded her, jokingly asking her to marry them as part of their routine. I think it's important to add here how well media trained they were. After Brian Epstein became their manager in 1961, he gave them the image of clean-cut, charming boys, very different from the Teddy Boy thing.
Yes.
Flirting was as much a part of their personalities as it was a part of their shtick. They were aware of who Jane was, having watched Jukebox Jury religiously. Paul McCartney said, quote, "We thought you were a blonde since we'd only seen you on TV in black and white, but you're a redhead." Jane self-consciously tucked a strand of hair behind her ear, remembering how she'd been teased as a child for her red hair. John then invited her along for the ride. Come with us. We're going to a party. As we know from the joint Beatles-Ronettes party in the last episode, the Beatles sure did love the nightlife. This party was at a journalist's flat on King Street. Despite Jane's intention to interview the band, the Beatles quickly turned the tables, interviewing her and trying to make her blush. John, who had been drinking and taking amphetamines, asked, "What do girls do when they play with themselves?" This is a classic John moment, pushing the envelope of what's acceptable. Jane, uncomfortable, decided not to answer. Paul stepped in, nudging John aside. "You seem like a nice girl," he told Jane, and then led her to a quieter bedroom off the main parlor. Paul geared the conversation to a much more tame topic, asking Jane about her favorite foods. They talked about food first, then music. Jane shared that her mother was a professor of oboe at the Guildhall School of Music and Drama, while Paul's father led a band in the 1920s and taught him to play the piano by ear. Jane mentioned they had a piano at her family's house on Wimpole Street, bracing for his reaction. Paul responded, "Wimpole, oh, like in Chaucer, fool samely here," showing off his impressive Middle English pronunciation despite his Liverpool accent. For context, Wimpole Street is a well-known, prestigious street in London's Marylebone area. Paul would have been aware that a high-class, well-to-do people populated the area, and Paul's little quip was in reference to the name Wimpole in a literary or historical context. He connected it to Geoffrey Chaucer, the famous medieval English poet known for the Canterbury Tales. I'm sorry for butchering that pronunciation if I did. It's been a long time since high school English class. In the context of Chaucer's Middle English, the phrase "fool samely here" is an archaic way of expressing something along the lines of "here the fool" or "this is where the fool is."
I think Paul's reference to Chaucer and his attempt at pronouncing Middle English, despite his strong Liverpoolian accent, really showed off his knowledge of literature and his ability to connect with Jane on an intellectual level. It was often said that Paul was fascinated by Jane's family and looked up to their knowledge and literacy.
He was also absolutely trying to impress her.
Oh, for sure. But I actually read a couple of articles and like things about them where it always said that Paul, who came from like simpler parents and not as much literacy and wealth as Jane did, really wanted to prove to the Asher family and their peers that he was as smart as them. Jane was charmed by Paul's charm and wit, noting how cute and smart he was. Before she could react further, John popped his head through the door. "What does he want?" she wondered. John announced they were heading to another party, but added, "She can come too." Jane glanced at her watch. It was just past midnight, and they had arrived at the party at 10:30. They had been talking for over an hour. "I should go home," she said. Though she wanted to stay with Paul, she felt tired and needed to be sensible. Paul quickly offered to walk her home, and it didn't take much to convince her. Jane couldn't believe this was happening. She later said she fell for him the night they met. He walked her home and asked for her number. She gave it to him, and they parted with plans to arrange a date. Later that week, Jane spotted him walking away with a noticeable bounce in his step. She could barely contain her smile as she went inside. Just to put things into perspective here, this was before the Beatles had their big break. They were on the cusp of Beatlemania, but no one knew what was about to come. Paul had been trying to secure a record deal for the Beatles, and their manager Brian Epstein had predicted that the Beatles would one day be bigger than Elvis, but most people had dismissed this as wishful thinking. Even George Martin, the EMI producer who eventually signed them, had been skeptical at first. Yet Martin had seen something in them, and now the Beatles were on their way to stardom. Jane's house on Wimpole Street was a six-story townhouse with plenty of room for Jane, her siblings, and even the four Beatles. Over the next year, it became a sanctuary for them, as the Beatles quickly rose to fame. Jane's mother, who struggled with chronic insomnia, was always awake to cook meals for the band, no matter how late they returned from a gig. It's so nice. I just want to say, from everything that I read, the Asher House seems like such a loving and wonderful environment to grow up. And all their kids, I love how they let them do whatever they wanted. Their youngest sister, Claire, did a little bit of like child acting too, mainly voice acting and like radio gigs. But then at one point she decided that she didn't want to do it and she became a school teacher. So I really love how every one of their siblings kind of found their way, and it seemed like the parents just wanted them to be happy. For Paul, the Asher household was like stepping into a different world, exciting and unfamiliar. Jane's father, the distinguished doctor, had a habit of giving himself injections at the dinner table. Jane's siblings, both actors, were always auditioning for various roles. Jane's mother's oboe students were constantly coming and going. The house was filled with music, jazz, folk, and classical pieces Paul had never heard before.
Jane could see that Paul was experiencing a bit of culture shock, especially during meals when her family enjoyed playing vocabulary games. Despite this, Paul was never shy about asking questions if he didn't understand a word or recognize a composer. He was keen to absorb as much knowledge as he could. He was really trying hard to impress the Asher family, knowing this was the way to Jane's heart. Paul was confident he could keep up with a family of intellectuals and sophisticates. Naturally, the Ashers liked Paul just as much. It was easy to warm up to him. He's always a bit self-deprecating, but very kind and always enthusiastic. One night, when he missed the train back to Liverpool, they offered him a place to stay. Initially, he hesitated, feeling it wasn't proper, but Mrs. Asher insisted. He ended up staying for 3 years, moving into the attic and becoming part of the family. I love that. Just to have that one person that you adore so much, you just invite to stay for a night or a weekend, and then they just stay.
It kind of reminded me of Edie Sedgwick, how she just decided to stay at someone's place for a while. Yeah. But I mean, Paul was very welcome there.
She invited herself.
Yeah, the Ashers really wanted Paul to be around. They really adored him.
Paul had lost his mother a few years before and was still grieving, but Jane's family welcomed him with open arms. Margaret gave him weekly music lessons, just as she'd done years earlier for George Martin, and taught him to read music well enough to transcribe the songs he was writing. The mental image of this prim and proper British lady giving a Beatle music lessons is so funny to me.
It really is.
Lennon and McCartney were starting to write some of their most beautiful work. They would retreat to the family's music room in the basement, working over the piano to perfect their chords and melodies. They wrote so many songs that they even had some to spare.
For me, this truly raises the questions whether the Beatles would have ever made it big without the help and love of the Asher family.
I think so. It just would have sounded a little different.
Yeah, because I, like, for me, I don't know whether this is true, but it seems like songs like Eleanor Rigby, that could be very influenced by that classical music that the Ashers told them and shared with them. So I feel like they probably would have made it big, but maybe their music wouldn't have been as complex. And I love how the Ashers were just like, come in, these like four random guys, you can like stay here. Yeah, we make you food all the time. You can hang out. We will teach you everything we know. It's such a wonderful environment.
Paul has always been such a sponge. You know, we see it at these family dinners. He's always so willing to learn. He was a really voracious consumer of American rock and roll. We see in Get Back that all four of those guys were walking Rolodexes of American standards. Yeah. They just break into song and like it's nothing. And heading into 1966, like you mentioned, Revolver, Eleanor Rigby, Paul is listening to all sorts of stuff, from the Liverpoolian bands that he grew up with to classical.
Yeah.
And the Beach Boys and John Cage, he loved it all. Paul gave his all to show the family how thankful he was for their care and support. As mentioned earlier, Jane's older brother Peter formed a pop duo with a school friend called Peter and Gordon. Paul wrote A World Without Love for them, which became a number one hit on both sides of the pond.
Please lock me away. And don't allow the day here inside where I hide with my loneliness.
By then, the Beatles were already chart fixtures. Among their hit singles was a song the boys wrote in the Asher's basement, I Wanna Hold Your Hand. This would be their first number one in America.
Oh yeah, tell you something, I think you'll understand.
As Paul and the Beatles' fame grew, it surpassed Jane's. Initially, when they went on dates, Jane would sometimes be recognized by fans of Jukebox Jewelry. But by the end of the summer, they couldn't walk around London without being overwhelmed by Paul's fans. He was the cute Beatle everyone wanted to date. While Jane was happy for him, she wasn't pleased with reporters constantly reducing her to Beatle girlfriend and always asking about Paul. In quotes, "It's such a drag," she once told in an interview. How would you feel if complete strangers asked you personal questions about the man in your life? It makes us laugh. It really does. It's nobody's business but ours. It's entirely between Paul and me. One night, after watching a Neil Simon play, they were photographed by the press. And from then on, they were hounded by photographers. The sidewalk outside Jane's Wimpole Street home often turned into a mob scene, with girls hoping to catch a glimpse of Paul. When asked about fame and fans, Jane once said in an interview, "Thank God I've never had the sort of intense fame that means you can't walk up the road. That sort of blazing stardom must be difficult to cope with and maintain. My career has just bubbled along happily." Jane's father figured out a way to sneak Paul out of the house by having him climb across the roof of the neighboring house.
Oh, we're doing parkour on the roof now?
I love it. I love that this, like, older gentleman who's this doctor is like, "Well, I talked to the neighbors. You can climb across their roof. It's fine." In February of 1964, the Beatles went to America for the first time, booked for 2 appearances on the Ed Sullivan Show. When they arrived in New York, the crowd was so massive that the band thought the president must be in town. But it was all for them. Beatlemania had become a global phenomenon. No matter where Jane went, she couldn't walk through a shop without seeing merchandise featuring her boyfriend's face. That must be weird.
Yeah.
Eventually, Paul managed to get a piano into his attic room, and sometimes he would wake up in the middle of the night with new melodies in his head and rush to the piano to play them. One morning, he excitedly played a song he had just composed, which he would eventually call Yesterday.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Jane followed him from her bedroom, still half asleep, and listened to the music that no one else had heard yet. Paul kept glancing at her as if she were a masterpiece to be admired, and she still hadn't fully gotten used to it.
Aww.
It's so sweet. There's something so sweet and innocent about their relationship, almost.
It's puppy love.
It really is. They were young. Jane was like 18 mm-hmm. at the time, maybe just turned 19. Paul was in his early 20s. And it was a truly different time than it is now. In 1966, after 3 years together, Jane and Paul moved into their own home. A charming 3-story house on Cavendish Avenue that Jane had found. She was 20 years old and Paul had just turned 24. While the other Beatles had relocated to the suburbs, Jane and Paul chose to remain in the city. They could afford to live anywhere they wanted. By then, the Beatles were the biggest pop stars in the world, even more famous than Jesus, as John had controversially stated.
Oh boy. Bigger than Jesus, Mark.
Oh yes.
That's like the turning point in Beatle history, you know?
It kind
if there were
of
ever
is.
An inflection point or a fork in the road, it was bigger than Jesus.
Yeah. As they began their 1966 world tour, the band faced intense hostility from the press and backlash from Americans over John's remarks and their stance on the Vietnam War. This difficult experience led them to decide against touring again in the future.
Yeah, and they'd just gotten so famous that it wasn't safe for them to tour anymore.
Yes. But it is impressive to me when I think back of how little they actually toured and how little of live shows they played compared to other musicians.
After retiring from touring, the Beatles decided to focus on recording at EMI instead. By now, the boys were using the studio as an instrument, "See Tomorrow Never Knows" off Revolver, a song that would have been impossible to replicate live in 1966. The Beatles anchoring themselves down was a relief for Jane. She found it challenging when Paul was away on tour, surrounded by girls vying to spend a night with a Beatle. That's the tricky part of dating a musician. You have to share them with everybody. They're married to the music first, not you. Even at their new home on Cavendish Avenue, which Paul had fitted with a substantial gate and an intercom system, determined fans would still camp outside at night. When Jane was cooking dinner, they would ring the doorbell and she'd answer them over the intercom, asking them to wait until after dinner, please, when she would send Paul out to sign autographs. That's so sweet. Have you seen those Polaroid photos of fans just turning up at Ken Fawn's and taking photos with George and Patty? It's like that. I can't believe this used to be normal.
Yeah, me neither. But I love how Jane was like, she didn't even like decline them. Paul at all.
She didn't send him home. She just said wait until after dinner. Wait a little.
I feel like that's probably her mom's upbringing. It seems like the Ashers were very, very friendly to everyone. Mm-hmm. And I love that. It's very sweet of her because, as we just heard, she didn't really love the fact that there were fans there all the time. But still, mm-mm, she decided to be really friendly.
She always tried to be kind to his fans, though they often called him on the phone too. That would annoy me.
Me too.
Because back then you couldn't just hit silent, you just have to take the phone off the wall. No matter how many times Paul changed their number, he usually answered with a funny voice, which was enough to spook the fans. Jane didn't mind much. She'd never wanted a quiet, ordinary life and had always planned to be in the public eye as an actress. Raised to constantly work and refine her talent, she remained committed to her career. Later, she confessed of her sneaking suspicion of Paul's affairs. She was never sure, though, so she decided not to bring it up. She kept herself busy with shooting films and starring in plays, trying hard not to put her entire focus on Paul. In 1964, Jane had starred in an adaptation of Edgar Allan Poe's The Mask of the Red Death, directed by Roger Corman. The year before that, she had a successful role in the film Alfie, opposite Michael Caine. Her career was flourishing, but it was also the source of many of her and Paul's arguments. Both were stubborn, and their disagreements often felt like a game. Paul would suggest she should retire, settle down, and be content as Mrs. Paul McCartney, while Jane would firmly reject the idea. They discussed engagement multiple times, but commitments with the band or her acting would always push those plans aside, leading to more arguments.
This reminded me a lot of Patty and George. Patty wrote in her memoir how George wanted her to retire from modeling. Patty did as he asked and admitted she later regretted it. But it has always been very interesting and kind of stood out to me that Jane and Paul didn't decide to get married right away. All the other Beatles got married pretty soon within meeting their girlfriends. Mm-hmm. And they have been together for 3 years at this point, which I would say generally was very unusual for young people in the 60s to not be married by then.
Yeah. Yeah, it feels normal now, but you have to think of how different things were then.
And it's interesting because I also read an article where she said she always wanted to be a mom and she always wanted to get married. So I wonder whether it were the sneaking suspicions of affairs or what it really was that held her back from just going through with it.
Mm-hmm. There's a gut feeling.
Yes. But I really love how she kept her independence and she didn't retire even though he asked for it. I think that's really great and that really speaks for her as a person, I think. After one heated dispute, Jane left for Bristol to join the Old Vic Theatre Company, where she was cast as Juliet. She knew Paul would be jealous of her Romeo, who would be sighing and pining for her nightly. Sure enough, the breakup didn't last long, and Paul wrote We Can Work It Out about their quarrel.
We can work it out. We can work it out. Think of what you're saying. You can get it wrong and still you think that it's all right.
They reconciled, and by the time Jane went on tour in 1967 with the theater company performing across Canada and the US, Paul insisted she go, recognizing the significance of the opportunity. He even flew out to Denver for her 21st birthday, and they walked barefoot through the snow-covered Rockies. That's sweet.
I think this was the trip where Paul came up with the concept for Magical Mystery Tour, because he stopped in Denver. So and spent time with Jane for her 21st. And then he continued on to California. And at Brian Wilson's house, I believe, he was sort of like, oh, I've been on this trip and like thinking about bus trips in England. Ooh, Magical Mystery Tour.
This was the kind of dynamic Paul and Jane had, always going back and forth between Paul supporting her, he was so proud of his beautiful and successful girlfriend, and asking her to finally settle down. Although Jane was glad to see Paul, she was frustrated that all anyone in America seemed to care about was her relationship with him. She was there as a Shakespearean actress, not just as a Beatles girlfriend. A reporter even ran a headline, "Shakespeare's the topic, Paul not to be mentioned." I think it's fair. I honestly think it is fair to wanting to stand for your work and not some bit about your personal life.
When Jane returned home after the five-month tour, everything felt different. The Beatles had started using LSD, which Jane disliked but was getting used to. The house was filled with new furniture and items she didn't recognize, and Paul and John, who were now closer than ever, often talking about their spiritual experiences with acid. Jane felt a new kind of jealousy, not over Paul's fans, but over his connection with John. In August, they attended a lecture by the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, an Indian guru. The Beatles were so inspired that they decided to follow him to Wales and then to India to practice meditation. They claimed it was a greater experience than drugs. When they later learned that their friend and manager, Brian Epstein, had died, the band's focus remained on the Maharishi's teachings. Jane didn't mind meditation. She thought it was a whole lot better than the drugs. But she was on the outside looking in as far as the Maharishi went. She couldn't fully grasp the Beatles' fascination with him. As their time at the ashram ended, under sticky circumstances, the Beatles' views on the Maharishi began to diverge. George still followed Hare Krishna, while the others were disillusioned. Similarly, the differences between Jane and Paul were more pronounced.
On Christmas Day of 1967, Paul proposed to Jane, and she said yes. It seemed like the right thing to do at the time. But just 7 months later, while appearing on a BBC talk show, she shocked Beatles fans all over the world. When she was asked how the engagement was going, she replied, in quotes, "I haven't broken it off, but it is broken off. I know it sounds corny, but we still see each other and love each other, but it hasn't worked out. Maybe we'll be childhood sweethearts who reconnect and marry when we're about 70. Reportedly, Paul was completely blindsided by this.
"I would be too if I found out my fiancé broke up with me on live television."
Yeah.
It's also odd that Paul was blindsided because Jane didn't attend the Yellow Submarine premiere with him 3 days before this, so there was clearly trouble in paradise, my guy.
Oh yeah, there truly was. And we will get to why that was now. Those words, "it hasn't worked out," echoed in her mind. A few days before, she had been released early from rehearsal in Bristol and went home to call Paul. She sensed something was wrong when she heard his voice and a girl's voice responding. "Paul," she called out, her throat tightening, but there was no reply. When she opened the bedroom door, she saw Paul and another woman in bed. Their faces turned pale as they looked at her. Jane quickly looked away, her world turning into a blur. Paul tried to explain it as a mistake, but his words were drowned out by the rush in her ears. Shaking, she walked out, deciding to have her mother collect her things. The thought of Mrs. Asher, who had taught Paul to read music, packing up her daughter's belongings, made Jane break down in tears. She had been with Paul since her teenage years, and now, as an adult, she was largely known as his girlfriend. The thought of what she would be without him was overwhelming. In a 1969 interview, she said, "I knew in my bones the break must inevitably come, a long time before it actually happened. Although we had this emotional thing for each other, we found it difficult to be really happy together." She continued, "Anyway, I promise you, I wouldn't not have had it happen. I mean, I am very, very grateful for those 4 years. And I am not going to look back in bitterness or anger, but only forward. People are such bores who make a drama out of their lost loves. In every case, someone has to fall out of love first."
One morning in March of 1969, as Jane browsed through the paper, she saw Paul's face next to a blonde woman. They were in formal attire, Paul in a tuxedo next to the smiling woman in yellow. They had just married. Paul moved on quickly. The woman's name was Linda, and she had a young daughter, Heather, whom Paul adopted. Jane wished them well, hoping everything would work out for Linda's sake. After their split, Jane found it hard to define herself again. It's worth noting that Women's Weekly cover story Emma just quoted was published just a month after Paul and Linda got married, so that would have been very fresh for her. For most of her teens and all of her adult life so far, Jane was with Paul, a Beatle girl, the future Mrs. Paul McCartney. Who would she be now without him? She knew one thing. She was an actress, and acting was what she loved and wanted to do. The next year, 1970, she starred in the independent drama film Deep End. Filmed in Munich, Jane portrayed a woman desired by a teenage colleague at a public school. This is her most critically acclaimed film, even praised by Twin Peaks mastermind David Lynch.
A favorite of both of us.
Yes. Jane continued to have a successful career in British cinema, television, and on stage, remaining constantly employed throughout her life. She is booked and busy. She still does plays, but also found her love of writing. Being talented, she soon became a prolific author. Despite many people from her past writing books about their time with the Beatles, like Chris O'Dell, Patty Boyd, even Jeff Emerick,
yes.
Jane never did. She never really spoke about it again. Sometimes in interviews, she nods at her time with the Beatles, but it seems after all these years, she doesn't want to be known as a Beatle girl anymore. She wants to be known and seen for who she is and what she's achieved.
I have to be honest here. I wondered when I read this whether she and Paul ever talked again after this, because I tried to look into this and I didn't see any pictures of them together. Apparently they do sometimes attend like the same things, the same events, because they're both still obviously huge British icons. But I haven't found any proof of them ever speaking again. And I honestly think that this is really interesting because it seems while Jane was heartbroken, she doesn't seem bitter. So I wonder why that was. She even said maybe they'll get back together when they're 70. And I mean, that obviously didn't happen because they have passed that age now and Jane is still very happily married. We'll get to that in a second. But I honestly wonder whether this was just her coming to end with it after it ended and just being like, this was a chapter of my life and I don't want to go back there. Or whether they may have had some sort of interaction within these past 50 years.
And just sort of kept it private, kept it on the down low.
That's something I can't really imagine.
Because
it seems like them.
Yeah, because they shared something really special with each other.
And it seems like they both still have a lot of love and appreciation for each other. No one really seems bitter in the situation.
No, no.
Jane turned her attention to fiction, writing three successful novels, none of which were about pop bands. Her knack for cooking and baking, which had developed even while she was with Paul, grew into several popular baking books. Abby and I have a particular soft spot for these books. Our personal favorite is one called Party Cakes. It has recipes for baking cake in the shape of a grand piano and a bathtub. You need to look this up.
After we were done recording the Ronnie Spector episode, we just stayed on the Zoom call talking about these cake books, because on the cover of one of them, there's a cake that's a grandfather clock, and it's standing up vertically, and we spent a solid 5 minutes wondering about the engineering of this vertical cake. Is it like a Cake Boss situation where there's like skewers and Rice Krispie treats, or is it just stacked like that? If you have these books, I want to know.
Yeah, me too. And I'm so tempted to order one. I found one. It's like $5. It's very cheap, but it'll take like 6 weeks to get here and be like $25 in shipping. But one day, I tell you, I need to get this book. And I truly love that she, even though she hasn't fully retired from acting, she still does acting gigs every now and then. I love that she found something else that she truly loves. Jane also built a lifestyle brand with her homemaking show. In the 1990s, The Good Life embodied Jane Asher's new public image. In quotes, "I'm not advocating we should all be back in the kitchen and cooking all the time, because life's too short. We've got more interesting things to do. But to rediscover the intense pleasure of making a cake and putting it down on the table is ridiculously satisfying, out of all proportion to the world." She also wrote books on making costumes, which is called Fancy Dress. She also wrote a book on making costumes, which is called Fancy Dress. And these are so magical and creative. It truly seems like she poured her heart into every single costume and recipe. I have to say, I found a lot of pictures out of this particular costuming book. It is costumes for children and grown-ups. And I love it so much. There are things like an octopus, and it's like a butterfly, and it is all very, very sweet and
cute.
Yeah, something about her seems so wholesome, and about the fact that she just decided to leave the whole Beatles thing behind her and make these wonderful books and just have this sweet little life.
What did we say the other week? Like a British Martha Stewart.
Oh, she definitely
is. Because it's like cooking and entertaining and lifestyle, costuming, table settings, I think, too.
Yes, decorations. Mm-hmm. There's everything and anything. I believe this woman is capable of absolutely everything. It seems like she masters whatever she touches.
She must throw such a good birthday party.
Oh, I would love to go there. And she also found love again. Gerald Scarf, 10 years her senior, was handsome and composed. He supported Jane's acting career and understood its importance to her. They shared interests and had a great sense of humor together. Jane felt she had found something special, and even after the birth of their daughter Katie in 1974, they waited until 1981 to marry. Around that time, Gerald gained recognition for his work with Pink Floyd.
Yes, yes, he animated for The Wall.
He did.
I'm wearing my Floyd shirt today, actually.
You're very dressed on brand.
I always dress for the theme, Emma.
He designed Pink Floyd's animations, stage sets, and covers for their album, The Wall. They had two more children, creating a large artistic family. When asked about marriage and having children during an interview for Women's Weekly in 1969, she said, "Oh, I would like to have children. I'm sure almost every girl feels like that deep down, but they are frightened of being laughed at. And you'd like to be married first in white in a church and all that jazz?" the interviewer asked. Jane replied, "I'm not sure about that. I am not in the least disapproving of anyone who had a baby without being married first. And I am certain that if Marian Faithfull hadn't lost her baby, Mick Jagger would have been a devoted father." Which we now know he is.
He's got so many kids.
Yeah, he is. But from what I heard, especially with like his one daughter, Georgia, who's like sort of in the spotlight too, she always says that he was a great father and that she had a great childhood. So Jane really had the right feeling about this.
As the Beatles' legacy is cemented, Jane, who remained in the public eye, is often asked about her past with Paul. The less reputable British tabloids have frequently offered her money to spill details. She's even less inclined to discuss him now than when she was when they were together. It's not that she doesn't have anything good to say or that she resents being known as a Beatles ex rather than an accomplished actress. It's also that her years with Paul were a very personal part of her past that she isn't ready to share. There were surely moments when she thought about him. The songs he wrote for her are still played often. She no doubt had Paul in her heart in 1980, when John Lennon was tragically shot, a loss that reverberated across the globe. All the Beatles, exes, and wives have all shared this experience that none of us Beatles fans will ever truly understand. Though Jane and John weren't close at the time of his passing, they still shared that experience.
Yeah, I think death kind of unites people. In the 1990s, as news of Linda McCartney's breast cancer and her death in 1998 made headlines, Jane was among the few who remembered Paul still grieving his mother, Mary, who had also died of breast cancer. She understood how profoundly the loss of his mother must have affected him, just as the loss of his wife must have. It had been 30 years since their time together, and both had changed significantly. They had been young and navigating the complexities of fame, and she couldn't truly know the person he had become over the decades. What remained clear was the deep impact they had on each other's lives. The Beatles, despite everything, never lost their popularity. They're still as well known as they were in the 1960s. Their music broke boundaries and defined an era, making legends of Paul McCartney, John Lennon, Ringo Starr, and George Harrison. But this isn't about them. This is about Jane, the one that got away, the one that was never bitter, the one that built a life for herself.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life and career of the incredible Jane Asher.
I really did enjoy this. As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you liked what you heard, don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite streaming platform. The button is somewhere around here. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your heart.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.